in the speaking queue, if that's not me being too authoritarian by asking everyone to do that. We've got Paddy. So yeah, Paddy, what's your contribution? Thank you.
Hi, thanks for those two talks. So some interesting points raised. I just maybe come back to some others later on, but something that Carla said about conformity experiments, it's funny, actually, it's quite coincidental, because I was having a conversation the other day with my daughter, actually, and I was telling her that somebody, I can't remember where it was, but somebody had explained that women and men behave differently when asked the same question. And the example they gave was, somebody comes into a room where there's a bunch of women and there's a bunch of men, and says, right, who's hungry? And all the men stick their hands straight up, and all the women look at each other. Anyway, I was telling my daughter this because I thought it was funny, and she said, oh, no, it's true. She said, I'm like that all the time. So we had a long discussion about that, and so we sort of tried to plumb the depths of why that might be, but it's to do with social validation, I think, and that it was to do with, I don't want to be the only one who's hungry, because I'll be putting people to trouble. If it's only me, I'll feel bad, so I better just check that I'm not the only one who's going to be doing this, something like that, whereas the men didn't care. They just thought, am I hungry? Yes, stick your hand up. Anyway, that was just a small point on that. Just just very briefly, you mentioned the sort of Milgram experiments and the Stanford experiment. I think the truth is a bit more complex than that with those experiments. There was a researcher called Gina Perry who got hold of the original papers, or as many as could be obtained from those two experiments. She did a report on these, a reanalysis of this back in 2012. Where she actually went to interview all the participants. So this was a long time later. She went to interview them all, and particularly the prisoners of the Zimbardo experiment. And what she found out was, well, it's sort of, you know, the way that Carla describes it, I mean, that's how the things were set up. But both of the researchers, Milgram and Zimbardo, only released certain of the results. They didn't release the whole thing, and they these wouldn't have been peer reviewed at the time, because they only released, you know, like I say, it was partial results that seemed to prove what they wanted to prove. But what Gina Perry showed was actually a lot more people did refuse than that had been claimed in the original results. So it was quite an interesting. Gina Perry, just to sort of Google her and look that up, because it offers a sort of slightly more, I think, kind of upbeat interpretation of what people are really like. For example, a lot of people, some of the people who agreed to apply the maximum electrocution thing afterwards said, oh, because you might say, oh, well, they would say that. But they said they were convinced the whole thing was a fake to start with, because no Ivy League university was ever going to squander its reputation by torturing people. So they just thought, that's a setup. So anyway, that's what they said. And lots of other people did press the button, but they were in tears when they did it. So, you know, they weren't keen to go along with it, let's put it that way. And they felt badgered by the experimentists who kept on and on and on saying, you've got to do it. It's in the interests of science and humanity. You have to do it. So they were completely badgered into it. So, you know, maybe that doesn't justify them doing it, but and some of the prison guards were paid. They were actually paid and told what they had to do to get their money, which was to torture the prisoners. And then a lot of them then refused. I think two-thirds of the guards, according to Gina Perry, two-thirds of the guards refused to torture the prisoners as required by the terms of their payment. So I think that, you know, it doesn't detract from what you're saying, but I think it's a bit more of a sort of nuanced view of it. Anyway, that's enough for me.
I think you're probably right there, Paddy. I think that probably was the case, but that's what all experimenters do, don't they? They only publish what they want to publish, and that's quite encouraging that more people didn't do it. I can imagine. I mean, I was shocked. I would imagine that most people would not do those things.
Okay, thanks. Steve's next in the queue. Thank you.
Hi, both question of mine. So I've parts of your talk kept cutting out on me. So apologize if I got all the wrong end of the stick. Just first of all, to back up to an extent what Paddy was saying. I think that the people that is long been a criticism of these psychology studies, that the people that they use as their guinea pigs are students and not necessarily representative of humanity in general. But let that go. And in a real life situation, in the Second World War, it appears that a lot of people who were in dangerous situations were refusing to shoot. They didn't take part in any battles because they had qualms about killing people. I mean, there has been that sort of evidence come out of the Second World War. But I just wanted to go back to something that Tim mentioned, to do with authority and the way that authority starts with the gods upstairs. And it's interesting from the time of the 17th century that it was recognised. I think it was James Stewart, who was, I don't know, James the First of England. I think it was him that said, if we don't have any archbishops, we don't have a king. There was a recognition at the time that the Christianity was a bulwark for royal rule. And in fact, this guy was one of these, I believe he's one of the first to argue, what was it called, divine... I've forgotten the bloody term. Yeah, he was appointed by God, this king, according to him, and the recognition that the church, the propaganda of the Christian church at the time, was absolutely vital to maintaining that power. So yeah, so for now, that's for me. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I think it might be the divine right of kings that you. We're referring to.
Yeah, that's
Tim. Tim, did you want to come back on that at all?
Yeah. On the point of the the experiments and things. I mean, I think that's right. There are always debates around the validity of research results, but I think in that context, just to substantiate what Carla's argument. I mean, the Nuremberg principle was relevant in this context, wasn't it? The authority of the Third Reich was such that the SS Guard's defence at Nuremberg was that they were following orders by pushing people into the gas chambers, or by executing them in other different ways, and they sat there, quite placidly, and quite convinced of the validity of their argument, that they were simply following orders. That authority structure was so intense that they thought that was justifiable.
Okay, thanks. Carla, did you have anything to add before we go on to Howard or not?
Nope.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, Howard?
A couple of things. Tim had this sort of list of areas in which authority is exercised and people accept it, religion, international organisations, etc. One of these was the workplace, and in many ways, that's the most authoritarian, isn't it? In as much as the authority structure there is sort of ingrained. It's sort of it's fascistic, but people don't recognize it as such. I mean, people might sort of resist international organizations or the state in various different ways. Very few people resist the authority of the workplace. I mean, Tim was saying he's done that in his life. Fine, yeah, not many people do. I remember, I think it was in the 1970s, that it became fairly common for people to talk about, unhierarchical employment structures where, you know, you didn't have managers and so on. That's completely disappeared now. It's taken for granted now. It's in everyone's head that they've got to have what they now call a line manager, and that line manager has got to have their own line manager, etc. So this is an area in which it's fascism at work without anyone calling it that, and people sort of not only accepting it but somehow sort of lauding that this is the way it's got to be. That's one point I wanted to make. The other point supports what Paddy was saying earlier about these horrible experiments. A book was published last year called Humankind by Rutger Bregman, in which he argues that human nature isn't what people think it is. He not only argues that human nature, as the party has done sort of consistently, that human nature is actually human behavior. He says that there is a human nature, and it's a good thing. People left to themselves behave in a kindly, empathetic way towards other human beings. And he tackles these examples in which people are, treated one another badly head on. Particularly, he talks about the Milgram experiment, and he says that they've been reported, as I think Paddy sort of suggested, in a very sort of partial way, the experimenters sort of reported the parts of the experiment that they found backed up their original agenda, and that lots and lots of people just would not do what they were being asked to do, regardless of the fact that regardless of the circumstances they found themselves in. The other thing Bregman talks about is what happens during wars. And in the book, he provides what seems to me pretty good evidence that very few soldiers in the trenches, for example, fire their weapons at the enemy when they could see them. And many of them deliberately fired their weapons into the air. And he says that during the Second World War, only a very small percentage of soldiers actually managed to fire their guns when they came into direct contact with the enemy, although they had orders to do so, although they were under authority to do so. So I think there's a fair amount of evidence which at least mitigates the sort of, you know, the authority-bound agenda which capitalism has, and probably sort of, says positive things about the way we look at the world and so-called human nature. Thank you.
Thanks. Yeah. Carla or Tim, did you want to come back on that?
Just briefly. Yes, Howard, I think you're absolutely right. But this chap, Bregman, whoever you talk about, he also will look for evidence that supports his theory. He's got a nicer theory, but he will also look for evidence and disregard other evidence. So I think, you know, as we know, there's no such thing as human nature. It is human behaviour, and we can be bad and we can be good.
You're absolutely right. He's got an agenda as well, obviously. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I completely concur with Howard in respect of the current state of workplaces. You know, they're more authoritarian than ever. And, I watched that transition over the years. I started in Lloyds Bank in the early 70s. The Bullock Report came out in 76, which was on industrial democracy and workplace democracy. And there were successive reports subsequent to that, these are government commissioned reports, because in the 70s, those concessions, a bit like the Roosevelt New Deal, those concessions were felt to be necessary in the capitalist context because there was such a strong antipathy to the workplace. You know, I mean, people in education then were not being educated to go into jobs. They were their education, you know, they were rebelling en masse against that. And so it was a real crisis. But since then, in the subsequent decades, all that's evaporated, all that kind of participative management, those kind of flat structures that they talked about, teamwork, rotating management, you know, all that's gone out the window. And now we're back to a kind of brutal, well, initially brutal system, but now a more subtle system with technology. It's the new managerialism. So technology is being utilized and expanded to manage people automatically, remotely, through surveillance, to key targets, and so on and so on and so on. And so, yeah, all those progressive managerial ideas have gone, partly, I think, because there's no need for them anymore, you know, because trade unions were so weakened under Thatcher and then successive governments, including Blair, that, you know, there's no need for it. They don't feel the need for it. They think they can do what they want now in organisations. And what they want to do is they want to replace people through technology, and the people that are left, they're going to manage through technology, through automated algorithms, remote system.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, Paul.
Yeah, thanks, mate. Yeah, thank you both, Carla and you, Tim. That was really, really good. Obviously, I've not been around for a few meetings for one reason or another lately, so it was really good to come back to this. I particularly like this style of two people talking and bouncing off each other. It reminds me of the one was at Howard and one of our other comrades done recently. It's a really good style, a really good format. But just getting back to the subject, the other thing I was going to say was, obviously there's only a handful of us here tonight. I think this particular talk is getting the quality to definitely be worthy of a repeat as well, so that more people can have the pleasure of listening to it. I really thoroughly enjoyed it. I think in terms of authority, I mean, there's no doubt about it. Some parts of the world are far more authoritarian than others, and it is very much a subjective kind of thing. You know, it's capitalism by its very nature depends on authority and dictators and dictatorship to a greater or lesser degree to have control. And that's probably what I would be inclined to label as an abuse of power and authority. I think when the time comes and we do establish socialism, everybody will be, you know, switched on to the benefits of working cooperatively and treating each other with respect and dignity. But I've no doubt there will still have to be some sort of order, you know, some level of acceptable behaviour that people will generally adhere to voluntarily, you know, in a cooperative way and for the benefit of all. But as far as the current world order is, authority is you know, it's ultimately a necessary part of it, and sometimes it can be advantageous and sometimes it can be not. You know, if you are going to come to any harm by someone who has maybe fallen foul of the law, then you'd like to think that the law will be there to protect you. And that's maybe not the best example, but again, you know, in a propertied society, the likes of which we live in, sometimes your own well-being and welfare depends on there being laws, but you know there's a level there. You go from brutal laws to fairly kind of not submissive laws, but subservient. I don't know what the exact word is I'm looking for, but you know, submissive kind of laws, I suppose, is what I'm trying to say. Where, you know, generally speaking, you have to go with the flow and the status quo, if that's the kind of deemed to be the acceptable way of behaviour. You know, I completely resent authority. I've got no time for it at all. But I understand the need for there to be certain rules and regulations in order, you know, to protect us. But you know, I'm not being defensive of the situation. I think it's just the nature of the world we live in, and that will undoubtedly change when the time comes and people are ready for our own new world order of socialism. But a terrific talk again. Please consider you guys run it again at some point in the future for some of the other comrades to hear. It was thoroughly enjoyable. Thank you both. Thanks, Mike.
Thanks. Yeah. Cheers. Yeah. And Carla or Tim, did you want to add anything to that?
No, not really, because I don't want to go into what it's like, what authority might be like under socialism, because that's for summer school. But yeah, thanks, Paul.
Yeah, I'll defer to summer school as well. Yeah, on socialism.
Yeah, I'm really, really looking forward to that, guys. It's going to be absolutely brilliant. I'm all booked up and ready to rock and roll. Got a nice bottle of whiskey there, just sitting, waiting to be popped for that weekend. So, be here before you know it. Cheers, guys.
All right. Cheers. Yeah, thanks. Yeah. Steve?
Yeah, thanks. Just very briefly, Tim was talking at length about...
Steve, you've gone.
...authority and law, etc. I've gone, sorry.
Yeah, sorry, do you mind starting again? Thanks.
So, I think I've disappeared.
Try again.
Yeah,
go for it.
Is that any good? No. I'm going to come back in.
Right, try again, Steve. Steve, we can't hear a dicky bird. If it's okay, Steve, do you want to maybe come back in a little bit later? Well, I'll go on to. Sorry, yeah. Couple of points. I wanted to make. I think the Milgram experiment's been repeated a few times over the years, and I remember seeing one of Darren Brown's TV programs, and they're always fascinating to watch, with the way he makes psychological manipulation look very easy, quite frighteningly so. And yeah, he did a repeat of the Milgram experiment, which I think had pretty much the same results, although I take the point that the original results might not have given the full picture, and you know, for all I know, what was on his TV program didn't give the full picture either. And another point I wanted to make was going back to authority in the workplace, and I suppose a naive view is that, you know, if you work hard, if you're good at the job, if you build up a lot of experience, then you'll sort of rise through the ranks. You'll, you know, get promotion, you'll get a better job, get a better pay, and, you know, more authority as a consequence of that. But of course, in the real world, it's not about doing the job well and proving that you know your trade. It's about how loud your voice is, how popular you are, how convincing you sound, whether or not what you're talking is a load of rubbish. So it's often the sort of the veneer of things rather than the substance, which lets people or enables people to rise up the ranks. And you know, even if it's hard to put into words, sometimes we can often consider someone as whether or not they're sort of management material just by the way they come across. And I'd say all of that is regardless of their actual talents. And I mean, I was just wondering how you know, what way round there is, because obviously confidence and being able to influence other people can come off the back of experience and knowing your job. But you know, like I say, often it doesn't, and it's hard to sort of separate the two, really. But yeah, I think in practice, those who emerge as leaders within the workplace, it relies on particular personality traits rather than on anything more substantial. And that's the problem, because certain personality traits lead to a very narrow way of doing a job often. And I'm starting to lose my point a bit, but yeah, I suppose, yeah, my point was, yeah, that authority is more a way of being or way of coming across rather than anything which relies on knowledge or experience or substance. And that's one of the ways in which authority manifests itself in a very unfair way, I find. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, I'd agree with that, Mike. I think, you know, like the personality, I think that the person that kind of climbs the ladder and gets to the top, it is a kind of personality. They're the personalities that, in my opinion, tend to be not submissive, but they know the right things to say and the right things to do. And they're kind of a bit sort of, you know, can be a bit wormish and just sort of rise to the top with no actual substance to them. You know, or they can be just really nice people and, you know, they're voted in for everything. So, yeah, I think it is definitely a personality thing.
Yeah, I think personality plays a part. I mean, I think you know, compliance and conformity is important, really, as it would be in any hierarchical institution like the military. And you know, the people that reinforce the system by compliance to authority are those people that are a safe pair of hands, really, irrespective of whether they've got competence or not. And the people that rebel against the system are always, an irritant at the very least, and a danger to it, because they create unrest in other people. So I think conformity and compliance is an important, characteristic for managerial potential.
Thanks. Yeah, Paddy.
Yeah, just a little bit more on that. It occurred to me on the those two experiments that we were talking about. You know, I think the Milgram one was 1950s, wasn't it? And Zimbardo was sort of early 60s, mid-60s. And I think they were related to a long-standing debate that had been going on ever since the war, particularly after the Eichmann trial and the sort of famous analysis done by Hannah Arendt about, because people wanted to know, how is it possible that someone as mediocre as Eichmann could have ended up doing such things. And was there anything in this idea that even quite banal people, quite boring people, can be made to do monstrous things simply because they've been told to? So this was the background for these experiments. Was the Nuremberg defence actually a real thing? This is what these experiments were supposedly designed to prove. And something that's been pointed out is when people write things, they've got an agenda, and that's true. The thing is that these were supposed to be scientific experiments. They're not, scientists are not supposed to have agendas. Now, sometimes they do have agendas. One notorious case was Bernstein. I think his name's Bernstein. He's quickly debunked IQ tests that supposedly proved that black American children had lower intelligence than white children. This was notorious because he also falsified his data and all sorts of things. A blatant agenda there. So it's not that scientists are never have an agenda, but the thing about science is it's fairly quick at uncovering that agenda afterwards and debunking that research. So I think Carla said something about medical incompetence, making mistakes and, doctors getting it wrong or being too arrogant. I mean, that all happens clearly, but, overall, science makes mistakes. Of course it does. It's done by humans. How would it not make mistakes? But, the process of science, I think, is an error-checking process that we, on the whole, I think you can trust the process, even if you can't always trust every single conclusion that it comes to. But just go back to the two experiments. I think now we would say the Nuremberg defence is a bogus thing. What was really going on, I think, would be we would say it was exploitation by the Nazis of what was already fairly endemic and widespread racism and hatred of the other, which they very expertly whipped up in the population. And the reason why these mediocre sort of bank clerks like Eichmann did what they did was because they were just racist and they really had no great objection to it. So they were quite keen to follow their orders, in fact. And we've seen actual examples of sort of things like tribal hatreds whipped up virtually out of nothing in places like Kenya and particularly in Rwanda, where the Hutus and the Tutsis, had lived side by side, or at least, they'd all lived together in the same villages for years and years and years without any problem. And political leaders, sort of would-be demagogues, sort of whipped up tribal hatred, very cleverly in order to garner support. And we've seen the same thing. You could argue a very similar thing has happened, maybe Israel and Palestine to a large extent, where, prior to 1949, they got on perfectly well. So, people can be manipulated, but I think the idea that ordinary people do monstrous things if they're told to, I think that's pretty much a bit bogus, frankly.
Okay, thanks. Looks like Steve's had to drop out due to technical difficulties, but he's left a comment in the speaking queue. Workers are conned into believing that politicians can actually control things when they end up merely reacting to and being driven by circumstances. And a comment by Jane and Tony, or Jane or Tony. Yeah, thank you.
A couple of things sprang to mind. I was thinking about the Nuremberg trials, and I was under bang orders, and I've always thought actually the guys in the dock who were saying that were thinking, well, your troops, your soldiers just follow orders and they do all sorts of shit. That sounds like that would work. If we just say we were doing the same as your soldiers, then what about? So I think it was a sort of, I have often wondered if it was a sort of attempt to a bit of a con, really, rather than actually a serious argument. And the other thing is, I was just thinking about the trade unions in the 70s, and then Carla's story about the anti-lockdown demo, and the sort of, well, the kind of, in a way, these experiments ignore the sort of, if you have a sense of power, then you don't feel like you need to comply. If you don't have a sense of power, like workers in the workplace at the moment, then a lot of the time you do feel like you have to comply. It's small groups of people having a demonstration feel like they have to comply because they're going to get battered shitless, large numbers of people demonstrating might not feel the same because they might not feel the cops can get away with it, et cetera, et cetera, just to take those two examples that were going on. So, and people were talking about maybe people were becoming more compliant and maybe there's another way of it, of looking at it and saying that people have less of a sense of their own power now, in which case the question is more, how do we get people to sense their own power rather than how do we stop them being compliant? It's kind of a more active kind of approach, maybe, that's all, if it makes any sense.
That made sense to me.
Yeah, I totally agree with that, Tony. About people's sense of power. We need. I think we've just been kind of so dumbed down that we all think we're powerless, but we're not. I mean, you know, we do everything. Those people are only there. You know, those people only have that power because we have given it to them, and we can take it away. And people, that's right. And we need to kind of, you know, let everyone know that we do have power.
Thank you. Yeah, Tim, anything to add on that?
Yeah, I mean it's sort of glass half empty or half full of it, really. I mean you can be pretty depressed about the current state of the world and the subjugation of peoples. Not everyone, there are pockets of resistance in different countries. It is a fact, isn't it, that if we get up in the morning and stop recreating capitalism, then it wouldn't exist. It's only by virtue of our subjugation, that's all of us, you know, by buying stuff, by going to work, by engaging the system, subjecting ourselves to all the authority mechanisms that exist to subjugate us. You know, if we said no to it, then it would just burst a bubble, wouldn't it? It wouldn't exist, you know. I mean, they've got a military and a police force, but, you know, they can't kill everyone. So, yeah, we create our own oppression, really.
Okay, thank you. Right, there's no one else in the speaking queue. Would anyone else like to contribute, especially anyone who hasn't already? Okay, and I've noticed it's gone 9, and any other contributions from anyone else?
Mike.
Yeah.
Can I ask Tim a question?
Oh yeah, go for it. Yeah.
Okay, Tim. I'm a nosy person, and I just find it fascinating that you're kind of ingrained hatred of authority, and you said that it's affected your relationships. I don't know how to put this. So if it's affected your relationships, then what drives you? What drives this? What is this inside you that's kind of interprets everything as being an order? Or not just a request. It must have made things very difficult for you, Tim.
Yeah, it's been a nightmare, Carl, in all respects. And in a way, I've been reasonably successful in navigating my way through it. But it's always easier for me to be on my own. And it's not a one way street. You know, it's not that. I cannot subject myself, you know, I find it immensely difficult. Obviously, I have subjected myself to authority in various ways, but because otherwise I would not have survived. But it's not because I have such antagonism towards authority. It's not just that I can't subject myself to it. I find it very difficult to subject anyone to it, you know, even to the extent of personally persuading them. You know, when I'm talking to someone and giving advice, you know, I'm hesitating because I think, well, is this a legitimate use? You know, because I have that knowledge or, you know, that skill. Is it legitimate for me to do that? So it's two-way street. So, you know, so, you know, it has been, yeah, sort of a nightmare, especially COVID. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, well.
But where it comes from, I mean, it is, you know, at my level, I think a pathological condition. Although intellectually, you know, it's an intellectual one now because I've developed that intellectual framework to explore it. But I think, you know, from a young age, it was just a kind of, I don't know why. It was just, I would not take anything from my parents, from any teachers at school, so on and so on. And that's been, you know, that's been my experience throughout.
Interesting. Thanks.
Okay, yeah, thanks. And yeah, no one else has popped up in the speaking queue. Carla or Tim, do you have any other sort of closing comments at all before we wind up for the evening?
No, I don't think so, Mike. I think
I don't either.
Okay, thanks. So, well, should we call it a night then? And I've really enjoyed it. Yeah, lots of points and ideas have come up. And I don't know about Paul's suggestion about a repeat performance. Yeah, maybe we'll see if that's something we want to do a bit further down the line. In the meantime, please revisit what's in the useful links. Text channel. So yeah, there's the pointers from Tim's talk, and yeah, apologies for some of the formatting errors in there, but hopefully it's still readable. And also the text of Carla's talk, and right up the list in the useful links as well. There's also a collection of 20 or so Socialist Standard articles going back through the years on the theme of authority. So if anyone else wants to read a bit more, then they're welcome to. There,
that selection of articles I had a look through, very good indeed. Yeah, definitely worth looking at. Well done.
All right, yeah, thank you. Yeah, well, we'll call it a night then. And thanks everyone for contributing, especially to Carla and Tim for putting all the time and work into their talk. So thanks also as well for the discussion. Yeah, I've really enjoyed it, found it interesting. Yeah, thanks everyone.
Yeah, thank you.
Very much, Mike.